Shrink Wrap Radio number 346, A New Paradigm for Thinking About Autism with Nick Walker.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Nick Walker, and we'll be discussing his experiences as an autistic person and neurodiversity activist. Nick Walker received his MA in somatic psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he now teaches in the undergraduate interdisciplinary studies program. We previously interviewed Nick on Shrink Wrap Radio number 323, on Aikido, empathy, and neurodiversity. He holds the rank of sixth dan, that's a sixth degree black belt in Aikido, and has taught the art of Aikido to adults, teens, and children for over 30 years. He's founder and senior instructor of the Aikido Shusakai Dojo in Berkeley, California. He is a dedicated autism rights activist and has been deeply involved with the neurodiversity movement for over a decade. He's a teacher, trainer, speaker, and consultant on a wide range of topics, including somatics, embodiment, autism, neurodiversity, conflict transformation, creativity, and transformative learning. He's also a contributor to the 2012 book, Loud Hands, Autistic People Speaking. Now, here's the interview. Nick Walker, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks very much. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on the show. We last spoke in October of 2012 about your experiences as an autistic person who is also an Aikido sensei. Mm-hmm. And since then, you've contributed a very fine article to a book titled Loud Hands, Autistic People Speaking, mm-hmm. which I gather is an outgrowth of something called the Loud Hands Project.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So maybe, well, before I go on, I just want to say that I'm really happy to have had the opportunity to read that book. I learned a lot. I think I hopefully will have grown in empathy. It's really given me a lot of material to chew on in regard to thinking about autism, and we'll get into that in our discussion here. Partly I learned from reading your article in there, as well as from those by other people, that language, how we talk about autism and autistic people, can be important, and there's a real effort by you and others to kind of reshape the language that we use. So
yes.
I want to apologize ahead of time because I may use old language that doesn't fit well into the new paradigm, and
no
so
problem.
I hope you'll be a bit forgiving of that.
But oh, of course. I'll mention it because I think it's a good thing to include in our mm-hmm. in our interview here. I think it's a useful learning opportunity for people listening if they can
sure.
understand, you know, we can discuss the language and why autistic people prefer a particular language.
Yes. So I think maybe a good place for us to start would be, what can you tell us about the Loud Hands Project? What is it? How long has it been around, and so on?
Well, it's very recent. It just came into being early last year. It's a project of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is a large national organization, a large autistic rights organization that does a lot of lobbying, a lot of activism. It's the largest and most effective organization right now that's run by autistic people for autistic people. So they've been around for a while, since 2006, and they're going strong. And the Loud Hands Project, some people who were involved with the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network had this idea of how to promote resilience and a sense of community, especially in the new generation of autistic people who are coming of age mm-hmm. right now. It's extremely helpful for autistic people who often grow up very isolated in non-autistic society. Very helpful to have autistic community, just like for any minority group, it's very helpful
sure.
to have a community. And So this question arose, well, how do we do this outreach? How do we reach out to autistic people, especially young ones, teens and young adults, and say, hey, we have a community, and this is what our community is about. This is the ethos of the community. This is sort of what we've come up with in terms of our own narrative about who we are in the world. And so the Loud Hands Project is aimed at that. And this anthology, Loud Hands Autistic People Speaking, which is, I hope this interview will get, you know, a lot of people to read it. It is available on Amazon. This anthology is really the first project of the Loud Hands Project, is the first thing the Loud Hands Project has produced. And there is a website in the works, which will eventually be very extensive and multimedia and be a library of all kinds of resources and information. But the book came first.
Yeah, great. Now, tell us about the title. I know it was discussed in the book. Tell us what the title Loud Hands refers to.
Ah, so a very common, all too common current practice in working with autistic children is behaviorist therapy, behavioral therapies that are based in behaviorist principles. ABA, or Applied Behavioral Analysis, is the big therapy. And the goal of ABA and other behaviorist therapies is to try to train or force autistic children to behave as much as possible outwardly like non-autistic children. It's just an attempt to train children into conformity. And this is very destructive. It's extremely bad for autistic children because autistic people do have their own particular ways of moving that are appropriate to their neurology and their own particular ways of learning. And if you force outward conformity, you're actually doing a lot of damage. There's a wonderful quote by a fellow named Todd Dresner, who's a parent of an autistic son, and he did a lovely documentary about autism a while back called Loving Lampposts, which I highly recommend. Anyway, Todd has this wonderful quote. He says, "The problem with trying to pound a square peg into a round hole is not that it's hard work. It's that while you're doing it, you're destroying the peg."
Yeah, that is a great quote. Now, autistic people are often seen, or children at least, are seen engaging in behavior that I think is referred to as flapping or hand flapping.
Exactly.
So Loud Hands, then, I gather, is a reference to not using behavioral principles
exactly.
to quiet those hands.
Right.
Rather, an assertion that, hey, we're going to speak loudly with our hands, and you better get used to it.
Exactly, that's where the title comes from, because it's a very common in ABA, in this behaviorist therapy, and just among classroom teachers of autistic children and parents of autistic children, the phrase quiet hands is one that we hear used a lot. They mm-hmm. tell kids quiet hands, which means keep your hands still. Yeah, don't move your hands around.
Well, like so many parents will say to their children, indoor voice.
Indoor
it's
voice.
Kind of parallel to that.
Right. And so quiet hands has become, the phrase quiet hands sort of has become symbolic of how autistic people are repressed in society, how that forced conformity, the whole idea of quiet hands, don't move the way that your body naturally moves, is representative of the whole attempt to enforce conformity to non-autistic behavior on autistic children. And so loud hands is, no, I won't have quiet hands, exactly, as you said, and it's reclaiming our right to be autistic people.
Yeah. Now, in the article that you contributed to the book, which I must say is a very scholarly written article, you talk about the need for a new paradigm when it comes to autism in particular and neurodiversity in general. What is the paradigm shift that you're calling for?
Well, I'm calling for a shift to what I call a neurodiversity paradigm. And the way I frame it is, currently disciplinary discourses in fields like psychology and medicine, neuroscience, education, and the public discourse around autism in general is based in what I call the pathology paradigm. And I'm calling for a shift to what I call a neurodiversity paradigm. Now, you could say the root of the pathology paradigm is this idea that there is one normal way for a human brain to be. This whole idea of normal, of a normal mind, there is a right way for a human brain to function, for people to think, for people to move. And if you deviate significantly from that norm, then there's something wrong with you. It becomes a pathology. And that's the paradigm that's currently used to frame autism and other neurological variations, like what we call ADHD these days, for instance, or bipolar. And the neurodiversity paradigm, by contrast, says, well, there's this idea of a normal brain is a culturally constructed fiction that's actually quite harmful. And that it's like saying that there's a normal ethnicity or a normal culture.
Yeah, it got me to thinking about even the idea of disability, that in fact, most of us are disabled in one way or another. I have hearing challenges, I wear glasses, and most people have some kind of little problem or another, either little or large. I noticed there was another word, you know, a sort of a hot word in this literature as I was going through the book, which was ableism. I've never encountered that word before. Tell us a little bit about ableism, because I think it fits in with what you're talking about.
There's a lot of cross-pollination between the neurodiversity movement and the disability rights movement. Some people regard neurodiversity movement as sort of part of a larger disability rights movement, and I certainly see them as closely connected. Ableism comes from the disability rights movement. It's a concept that it's an equivalent to racism or heterosexism, homophobia, or sexism. It is bigotry around the issue of ability, prejudice and discrimination around the issue of ability. So just as racism will say there's one master race or one race that's great, and if you're some other ethnicity, then you're inferior, you're not part of our privileged elite. The same thing happens, of course, with homophobia or transphobia. And then we see a similar dynamic with ability, where disabled people are very marginalized, where there's an able-bodied norm that's established, a certain cultural norm, a cultural ideal of this is how a person should function, and then there's discrimination against people who visibly don't measure up to that norm, and so it functions in the same way as any other form of prejudice.
So what is it that neurotypical people need to learn?
I think it's important just to understand the concept and to recognize, again, the neurodiversity paradigm, to elaborate on it further. Basically, the neurodiversity paradigm boils down to neurodiversity, the diversity of human minds and human brains, is a form of diversity like any other form of diversity, like sex and gender diversity, like ethnic and cultural diversity. And like those other forms of diversity, it's subject to power dynamics, dynamics of power and prejudice, where minorities get oppressed and discriminated against. Like other forms of diversity, it's also potentially enormously culturally enriching, enriching to a culture, enriching to a society to have that kind of diversity. There is great strength in diversity in a group or a society that integrates it well. And I think awareness of it as a diversity issue is crucial. We're in a culture and a society that still has a lot of problems around racism, around sexism, around just dealing with diversity in general. Among more enlightened people, there's an awareness that this is an issue. If we're good people, we don't want to be bigots. We don't want to be racists. And we want to, you know, confront our racism and think about how we can be inclusive and how we can respect other people's ethnicities and cultures and sexualities. And so to take that same approach, neurological minorities to neurominorities, as I call them, is what I'm advocating.
Yeah, because there's been almost zero awareness of that. Just reading this book has certainly raised my awareness of it. And your article was very scholarly a number of the other articles were very personal. They came out of blogs. Evidently, the blogging has served this movement quite well, and there's some really articulate bloggers out there. And it became apparent to me that much of this movement grows out of frustration and anger. What can you tell us about those sources of frustration and anger?
Yeah, I think every civil rights movement grows out of frustration and anger, because when people are oppressed and marginalized and silenced and don't have a voice, and how they're treated badly in society and don't have a voice in the discourse about themselves, well, of course that will create frustration and anger. So I think we see that in any kind of civil rights movement or movement for social justice, it always has frustration and anger and at its roots, and that's what motivates people to say, oh, I don't like this, I want to change it. The popular discourse, both in the mass media and in academic and professional discourse, the dominant discourse on autism is very bad and not inclusive. Autistic people, autistic perspectives are not in there. And in fact, we're often talked about as if we don't have a perspective, as if we're simply not self-aware. And if you think about the things that are said about autistic people by non-autistic people who make their living as autism experts, it sounds very much like, you know, things that were said about Jews in the days leading up to the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. People are burdens on society. They have no capacity for empathy or capacity to be good citizens. They're a menace. They're not capable of contributing productively to society. You know, these things have traditionally been said about any group that's seriously oppressed. And that's the current discourse on autism. And that discourse is reflected by treatment. But we have these treatments like ABA, where autistic children are just, the goal is to try to make them indistinguishable from neurotypical children. And we're seeing now a generation of autistics who were subjected to ABA and are coming of age, and they have PTSD, you know, they have PTSD from what was done to them. In the Loud Hands book, of course, the editor of the anthology, Julia Bascom, has an essay in there called Quiet Hands, which is a first-hand account just of the damage that was done to her by ABA and how she's still traumatized by that. And I think that's there's an enormous amount of that, of trauma. There's still situations, autistic children are murdered by their parents often, you know, because there's such a narrative of autism. In the overall culture and in the popular media, there's this narrative of autism as a devastating tragedy, as a death sentence, and it puts parents of autistic children in a state of despair. Several times a year, we see cases of autistic children murdered by the parent, by their parent, by their own parents or caregivers, and the media often frames it as, well, this is to be expected.
Yeah, I was unaware of that. I don't recall reading stories like that in the media. I'm not saying that they're not there, but reading the book, I saw that kind of phenomenon referred to pretty frequently. And certainly it came as a surprise to me how extremely articulate and persuasive the contributors to the book are. Some of them, two of them, I think, are maybe high school students. And I got the impression that one or more might not even be able to have a conversation such as we're having now in words, but that they can write very forcefully and very clearly and with so much feeling. So that was kind of an eye-opener for me, and I suppose it's symptomatic of what you're saying about society in general, that we have kind of a narrow view of what autism is and what a person can achieve who is autistic.
Right, and there's been, and that's been a big issue in the popular discourse and the professional discourse. Often people make a sort of an artificial distinction within the autistic community. It's very clear that it's quite inaccurate, but there's sort of a distinction between like the so-called high-functioning autistics or Asperger's autistics and autistics where they say, well, they're low-functioning or they're not self-aware, they can't communicate. That distinction turns out to really be a false one when you actually actually get to know a few hundred autistic people, you say, oh, there are people, there are very eloquent and influential autism rights activists who don't speak, and they're eloquent typists. They can write given the technology. And I think the increased access to technology, to computers and keyboards and the internet and text-to-speech technology, has really changed the conception of the capabilities of autistic people, including those who can't speak and who used to be labeled with terms like low functioning. Functioning is a problematic term anyway, because it implies that there's one right way for humans to function. But there's autistic people who may appear, if you see them face to face, you might say, well, can this person communicate with me at all? You know, are they thinking? You know, are they, you know, how much is going on in their heads? But you put them in front of a keyboard and give them the training and the means to type out what they're thinking, and it's, oh, well, this person's extremely eloquent and deep here.
Wow. So that's a phenomenon that you've witnessed. Because I can remember years ago, there was a show, I think it might have been on 60 Minutes, and they showed somebody who I believe was autistic, who couldn't speak and who was thought to be, you know, beyond the range of communication, and an assistant who would put their hands over the person's hands on a keyboard, and then this person would type out really eloquent messages. Now, this got the interest of people in psychology, and so there were some studies done. I followed up on it because I thought, wow, this is remarkable. I want to find out about this. And what I discovered was that there was some real scientific controversy about whether or not these helpers were unconsciously influencing the communication, and that the communication was really coming from the helper. But it sounds like what you've personally witnessed and what I'm witnessing in reading this book is that it's true that there are people who don't speak or can't speak who can be very articulate on the keyboard.
I mean, yeah, what you're talking about is called facilitative communication.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and it's there was a lot of controversy about it, and I think there still is controversy about it, because it has been subject to abuses, again, where sometimes the person, you know, the person who's the helper is actually providing the words. But my experience, just knowing a lot of autistic people who communicate with facilitated communication, is that's actually a rare thing, and it's something that's easily preventable. It's only the idea where the person who's supposed to be helping with the communication and just helping with the coordination issues is actually providing the words, and it's not really the autistic person speaking for themselves. That can only happen in a situation where the autistic person has not been provided with a means of signaling, you know, saying, no, no, this isn't what I meant. Or when you only have one helper all the time. If you have multiple helpers, then you can see better what's going on. My friend Amy Sequenzia, who is a wonderful, very eloquent autistic activist and poet, she's got some pieces in the Loud Hands anthology. Amy is one of those autistic people who does not speak at all and types with assistance, and very eloquent activist and a lovely poet. And she has multiple people who assist her at different times.
Now, what is the assistant doing?
The assistant is helping with just the physical tasks. You know, she has trouble, a lot of trouble with coordinating the body, her body and stuff like that. So just the physical tasks. Here's your keyboard, you know, you want to type, you know, she signals she wants to type. Here's the keyboard, just kind of making sure everything's in the right place for her to do it. But when Amy types and get an online conversations with her, and I read her poetry, and her style of poetry, which is very distinctive, remains the same regardless of who's helping her at the time.
Okay, that's a good control.
And I've seen that a lot, because there are a few autistic poets out there, non-speaking autistic poets. So yeah, you can see that. And with autistic activists, of course, who are very outspoken, if somebody is messing with what they're saying, they're going to speak up about it. They've got a helper who's like distorting what they're trying to say. The next time they get a different helper, they'll be like, hey, don't let that other person around.
You know, coincidentally or synchronistically, there was a report in the national TV news just a couple nights ago about a facility in Oakland, California, near where we are, where autistic people can come to engage in creative expression. They have all sorts of art materials available there, and they showed some amazing examples of people who are not able to communicate verbally but are extremely expressive artistically, including one person whose abstract paintings sell for thousands of dollars. Do you know anything about that facility that I'm referring to?
Yeah, I don't remember its name right now.
It's something about expressive arts. So that was quite notable. It really fits into the kind of phenomena that we're talking about. I've heard that some parents of autistic children are critical of news coverage highlighting so-called high-functioning autistic people because they feel it gives a very misleading impression that's totally unlike the challenges they find themselves dealing with on a day-to-day basis. What are your thoughts about that?
I've seen that. I've seen those criticisms, certainly. They can be very heated, in fact. There's a lot of strife often between parents of autistic kids and some autistic activists. There can be a lot of strife sometimes, whereas other parents of autistic kids have found that it's very helpful to them to talk to autistic adults and autistic activists, and their kids have really benefited from that, from contact with autistic adults and non-autistic parents learning from autistic adults. I think that the parents who are critical are missing some crucial points. What's happening is autistic people have a different developmental trajectories, and different developmental milestones reach at different times than non-autistic children. And of course, as I said, there's this enormous tragedy and catastrophe and disease and epidemic narrative in the popular media and in some professional discourse around autism, and that creates an atmosphere of constant fear and anxiety for parents. You get some non-autistic parents who don't know autistic people, and they have an autistic child. They're having a lot of trouble with the child because they don't know how to meet the child's needs. The child's needs are different from their own needs. The child's mind is very different from theirs. You know, autistic mind, very different. The child's sensory experience is extremely different. So often the child is having enormous difficulty because the parents and the professionals around the child don't know how to meet the child's needs. And they're kind of struggling and floundering, and it's very problematic, and they're freaked out. They're worried. Are we going to be able to communicate? Is my child going to be able to have a fulfilling life? And then they see autistic activists who are blogging and publishing books and out there speaking or publishing or making art. They say, well, this person is not like my child. That's the not like my child argument. This person is not like my child and can't really speak for my child. The point that these parents are missing is that most of these autistic activists that seem so, quote, high functioning, unquote, actually were like these children. And you would not necessarily have guessed when you saw them as children that they were going to grow up to be very effective and articulate activists or writers or artists.
Well, that's a very hopeful message. I'm under the impression that current thinking in neuroscience views autism as resulting from a mix of genetic and environmental factors. And of course, scientists hope that they might eventually understand these factors sufficiently to reduce the incidence of autism. Do you regard this effort as good science or as oppression?
I think it's oppression. I think it's a terrible mistake. It's ethically very unsound. And I think, quite frankly, it's genocide. I mean, it actually meets the United Nations Charter, you know, definition of genocide. One of the definitions of genocide is attempting to prevent births within a particular group. So if you're trying to create a world without autistic people, it's no different ethically, I think, than trying to create a world without Jewish people or without black people or without gay people. You're dealing with a genocidal intention and an intention to reduce the natural diversity of the human species. And I think that's very risky.
Well, let me push you just a little further on this. What if parents could choose between having an autistic child or not? For example, let's pretend it were discovered that by not eating blueberries, people would be guaranteed of not having an autistic child. And I think most people would choose not to eat blueberries. What's your position on that hypothetical?
blueberries are really good.
I know. It's probably a bad example.
So, well, I think this is a real problem. Currently, I think you're correct. Currently, if an easy way were discovered for parents to not have autistic children, I think a lot of parents would take that option. And I think we see that. We've seen that, in fact, in practice with Down syndrome, because the genetics of Down syndrome are much simpler than the very complex genetics of autism. And so a prenatal genetic test was discovered for Down syndrome a while back. And as a result now, what's happened is that the Down syndrome population has been decimated. Over 90% of fetuses with Down syndrome are aborted now. I regard that as a terrible tragedy because as a former special ed kid, I knew a lot of people with Down syndrome.
Well, they tend to be very gentle and very loving.
I hate to stereotype any group, but it actually has been my experience that they've just been a great bunch of folks, and I miss it. I mean, I still know people with Down syndrome, but I don't see as many young ones as I used to, and I miss their presence in the world.
Do I recall correctly that you have a daughter?
I do have a daughter.
Is she neurotypical?
She is not autistic. She's basically neurotypical. She's interesting. I suspect that my autistic genes had a little influence because she's definitely not autistic, but she is a little bit of a prodigy about some things. I think she got all the right genes. So she's not, but she's a very interesting child actually for an autistic person to have, because one of the biggest challenges for autistic people is it's challenging them for them to pick up on the subtleties of neurotypical social styles.
I wondered what the challenges would be for you and what they would be for her.
It turns out my daughter is a social prodigy. She's really funny. I mean, she's got this like level of focus that maybe she picked up from me, because autistic people do have a high level of focus on things they're interested in, but her focus is entirely social, and she's got these really advanced social skills. I mean, one of my biggest challenges as a parent has been making sure that she has a good grounding in ethics, and then, you know, a good heart, because she can talk other kids into anything. She's so persuasive and so advanced in her communication skills. A lovely child, very smart and very fun.
Did you ever feel the need to kind of sit down and sort of have a conversation about your status as an autistic person?
I have not had to have that conversation with her yet, but it will come up eventually.
How old is she now?
She's six.
Okay, she's really young. I was picturing a teenager.
Yeah, socially, sometimes she does act like a teenager. And right now, what she knows is, you know, she loves books. And what she knows is that Daddy writes, but Daddy writes boring grown-up stuff. When she's, you know, 10 or 12 or something, she'll become interested in what it is actually that I write. It has certainly not been a problem for me parenting a child who's not autistic. I mean, obviously, I live in a world where the majority of people are not autistic. I'm trained as a psychotherapist, but I've been teaching Aikido to non-autistic people all my life. So I have a lot more practice communicating with non-autistic people than they have communicating with me.
Now, I know that you've also been leading workshops on empathy. What can you tell us about that
work? Oh, I love that work. I got into it through teaching Aikido. Through my many, many years of experience teaching Aikido, over time, there was a shift in my own approach to Aikido from when I was young, as autistic children get bullied a lot often, and I was just looking for a way to fight better when I first started Aikido when I was 12. But over time, the Aikido made me a much more compassionate person, and I watched it have that effect on other people, and I that was actually the intent of the person who founded the art, was to promote a more compassionate world. And so I really got into teaching Aikido as a compassion practice, among other things. And when I started studying somatic psychotherapy, of course, I really got deeper into that and looking at how relaxing bodily tensions and cultivating a certain relaxed, open physical presence can contribute to empathic communication. And then a couple of years ago, I met Carla McLaren, who is, if you haven't interviewed her yet, I highly recommend talking to her sometime. She's a very wonderful person. She's an author and an expert at empathy. She's got a lovely book called The Language of Emotions, and she's just finishing up another book about empathy. And she teaches workshops and retreats and such in empathy. She's been doing that for years. And so we met. She was interested in autistic people and their experience of empathy. And we met and started talking about my interest in empathy and embodiment, empathy and somatics, and just decided we just had to collaborate. And so April 6th, we're co-teaching in Berkeley our second workshop on embodiment and empathy. And we're planning for more down the road. We're planning to keep this collaboration going and keep teaching the use of embodiment practices and somatic practices in empathy and generating more empathy and compassion.
I think we're at the point where we'll be winding down. So I wonder if there's any final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Yeah, I definitely encourage people to check out the Loud Hands anthology and to think, for people who are unfamiliar with this idea of neurodiversity or interested in a better understanding of autistic people, to start thinking about it as a diversity issue and looking at it that way, and also to start thinking more about, well, what are the benefits of having autistic people in the world? There's a certain something that I think the autistic mindset contributes. There's a certain capacity for thinking outside of the box and recognizing patterns in certain ways that I think is extremely necessary. I think that humanity right now, in terms of what's happening with our growing population and climate change and economic crises, I think humanity is coming to a real crisis point right now where it's going to take all of our intelligence to, as a species, to come to a good solution. And so this is not a time where we want to be reducing the diversity of human intelligence. It's a time where we want to look at every human being's unique intelligence as a resource, and how can we bring that all into play?
Well, that's a great close, Nick. And this has been a fascinating conversation, and it's definitely opening my mind up. And I know that many of my listeners are people helpers and one sort or another, and so I will certainly be recommending the book Loud Hands to them. So thanks for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but as a result of reading the Loud Hands book and the conversation you just heard with Nick Walker, I have to say that this old dog has learned to open up to some new levels of empathy. I have to confess that I had some resistance to reading the Loud Hands book when it first arrived. Part of me just didn't feel up to being harangued by another angry, disenfranchised minority group with dubious claims that their affliction was no affliction at all. As you may know, there is a contingent among the deaf who are quite militant and very opposed to deaf children being adopted by hearing parents, for example. There are similarly outspoken groups among people diagnosed with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, dwarfism, and other examples. Of course, nobody wants to have a label, especially a pathological label, hung on them, me included. Well, as I got into reading the book, I was really impressed by how passionate and articulate and clever various authors were. Yes, they are angry, but as I read more, I began to empathize with their position as I understood it more clearly and saw it through their eyes. Much to my surprise, I found myself laughing out loud, in a good way, in response to some of the contributions. Some of the writing was just so clever and original that I found it delightful. So you might have some similar resistance to reading a book like this, thinking that it will be a bad trip. I really encourage you to override that resistance if you have it. I think the Loud Hands book, as well as my interview with Nick Walker, deserve wide circulation among the general public and us professionals who are supposed to be enlightened. As I mentioned the last time I interviewed Nick Walker, there are some past Shrink Wrap Radio episodes which would make good companion pieces for this episode if you haven't heard them or would like to review them. I'm thinking of number 267, The Horse Boy, with Rupert Isaacson telling the story of his family's journey across Mongolia in search of a shaman who could heal his son's autism. Also, number 246, Exploring Savant Syndrome, with Daryl Treffert, MD, with Savant Syndrome being one variant of autism. And, of course, number 268, Visual Thinking in Autism, with Temple Grandin, PhD. Now, I'm not sure that each of these has an outlook that jibes perfectly with Nick's views, but still, I think they do provide good background and perhaps food for additional thought in the light of what Nick shared with us. Each of these bears on the subject of autism and underscores the value of different ways of perceiving the world, just as Nick Walker suggests. And of course, you will find the book Loud Hands on Amazon in both, I believe, a paperback and a Kindle version. And you can always order that from our site using the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar.
Hi, I'm Heather. I'm a graduate student, and I was really excited to stumble upon Shrink Wrap Radio and an article with an author whose articles I've been reading recently. It was very cool to hear. I chose to send a contribution to Shrink Wrap Radio because I really want to support this kind of grassroots educational initiative that's being done. I made a small contribution, and I figure, you know, for every I gained something from it by listening to it, and I would like to support that being out there for other people to hear, and I just, it's a really cool thing that you guys are doing, and so thank you.
Thanks, Heather, for sharing your story of why you choose to support Shrink Wrap Radio, even while on a student's budget. And while we're on the topic of supporting the show, somewhere between 7,000 and 20,000 people listen to any given episode. Compare that to the fact that somewhere between 20 and 30 people make a regular contribution to support the show. I'm constantly being urged by marketing types to stop giving away so much content for free. However, as you know, I'm reluctant to change the model. So won't you please help me to continue things as they have been by clicking on the multicolored support button on our site to make a one-time or ongoing donation towards the support of Shrink Wrap Radio. As I've mentioned previously, I know many, if not most of you, are listening to these interviews on a mobile device, but I really want to encourage you from time to time, at least, to actually go to our website at shrinkwrapradio.com to check out some of the special offers that won't show up on your mobile device. One example is the link in the right-hand sidebar that will help you to actually make money filling out surveys with one of my marketing research partners. Another example is if you go onto the site, you'll find a new logo for the Neuropsychotherapist magazine, online magazine, that has finally come out with its official premiere issue. All of you who are fans of the neuroscience interviews I've been doing lately, plus the ones that focus on how that new science will impact psychotherapy, well, you all will be definitely interested in this online magazine. It has extremely high production values, which is to say, it's very beautiful to look at. The publisher, Matthew Dalitz, is a Shrink Wrap Radio listener in Australia, and he has assembled a stellar advisory board, of which I am proud to be a member. You must check it out by clicking on the Neuropsychotherapist button, which you'll find just beneath the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar. And of course, another reason to actually go to the website is so that you can click on that support button that I mentioned earlier. If you're a new listener, you might not be aware that we also have an extensive list of continuing education courses on our site. You can earn CE units just for listening to Shrink Wrap Radio interviews and answering some true-false questions about what you've heard. You'll find these by clicking on the Store tab at the top of our site. Finally, I'm happy to report that thanks to listener Gloria Ullman, we have a new transcript on the site. It's number 342, Exploring Archetypal Patterns with Jungian analyst Michael Conforti.
Hi, this is Susie Gruber.
And Jerry Allen.
Somatic experiencing practitioners.
And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, we are going to have more input on somatic experiencing with upcoming guests Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen. I'll say more about that, but let's start out with some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from a listener in Turkey who had not been able to get Shrink Wrap Radio there since I stopped double posting the shows on Mevio. I'm not going to read this listener's name in case there's some sensitivity about being in therapy. The letter goes, Dear Dr. Dave, how are you? I hope everything is fine and you are very well. Let me give you the good news. A week ago, I was searching the internet and tried once again to get Shrink Wrap Radio. And to my surprise, because it has been nearly 2 years that I couldn't, but this time I was able to access your website. It seems that the problem has been solved, but I don't know how. Well, we don't care so much about how as that it has been solved. And they go on. Anyway, I'm very happy to have the opportunity to follow your podcast again. By the way, my therapy is going well. I'm going once a week. EMDR is really interesting. It's like a time machine. It enables you to travel to your past while you're still awake. It brought back vivid emotional memories and helped me to see some meaningful details in a greater picture. Hope I will gain more insight in the course of time. Hope to hear from you. All the best. I am so glad to hear from you, listener in Turkey, and really pleased to hear that you're now able to access the website. I'm really glad to hear of that positive change there in Turkey, and really glad to hear about your excitement and progress with EMDR. Actually, in a moment, I'm going to read an email from James Alexander, who uses EMDR in his treatment, and what you're saying really backs up what he has found in the psychotherapy that he does. So moving along, next we hear from Sven, somewhere in Sweden, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, at long last, I've just submitted my long overdue second contribution to keep you well and alive in the anticipation of many podcasts to come! If PayPal does its thing, there should now be another couple dollars for you in their books. Although you have a long list of suggestions already, I still thought of a topic that might be worthy of scrutiny, seasonal and otherwise, endocrinally precipitated disorders. Many people suffer the blues or worse seasonally, and we all know about teenagers, the midlife crisis, the seven-year itch, the menopause, and all the other myriad syndromes that are, I guess, as much due to shifts in the hormones as in the mind proper. Best regards and many thanks for your educational effort, Sven. Well, that's an interesting suggestion, Sven. It's a new suggestion that no one else has made, and so I will try to keep that in mind. Something about hormones and how hormones affect our psychology. Actually, I just did an interview. It hasn't come out yet, and I think I mentioned this in my letter to Sven, in my reply to Sven, of an upcoming interview with Whole Psychiatry founder Dr. Robert Hedaya. And so we actually do touch on some of those factors, so that might be of interest to you. And thank you for remembering to make another donation. I really appreciate that. Finally, it was nice to get a quick note from Dr. James Alexander, whom I interviewed recently on Shrink Wrap Radio number 341, on the hidden psychology of pain. And James writes, Good day, Dave. Hope you are going well and over your head cold by now. I presume you must be moving into your spring by now. We are moving into our autumn. Still enjoying your podcast, so keep them coming. Best wishes, James. Well, James, thanks for inquiring about my health. If you listen closely, or maybe not even so closely, you may notice that what was a head cold has really settled in my voice box. And although it's now 4 or 5 weeks going, I still don't feel like I've got my normal voice back. It's a little frustrating. Hopefully it will go away someday. And yes, we are moving into spring, and there in Australia, you're moving into autumn. And hopefully you heard this previous email that I read from Turkey, where the listener is reporting good results as a recipient of EMDR and really reinforcing what you reported, that EMDR is a powerful tool for helping people to uncover hidden, long forgotten, repressed, suppressed memories. So that's wonderful. And by the way, I should hasten to mention that Dr. James Alexander has one or more pieces in that online magazine that I mentioned earlier, The Neuropsychotherapist. So congratulations for that work, James, and that visibility for your work. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And I'll read them on air unless you tell me not to. Well, I don't promise to read them all. I have to back up. But I may read them on the air unless you tell me not to. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Sensei Nick Walker, for sharing his passions regarding a new paradigm for understanding autism and neurodiversity in general. As I mentioned earlier, my next guests will be Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen, a team I think you'll find very interesting for their application of Peter A. Levine's sensory experiencing to a court-mandated population through a local child protective services agency. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.